morning to you. Hoping you're in fine fettle this morning. Welcome to A Country Breakfast on RN. My name's Libby Price. Things are looking up for both beef and lamb producers. Today, we'll meet a Kimberley pastoralist who reckons he's never seen prices this good for cattle for the live export market.
Don't any of them politicians upset those Asian countries, for God's sake. Now, it's all looking good. And in fact, my bank man came around last year and he was very positive about the industry. But that's a good sign. When the bank man's a positive, it's a good sign.
Don't we all love a happy bank manager? That story coming up on A Country Breakfast. And we'll travel the country with our rural reporters. But before that, let's find out what's been making news this week with Tony Allen. And Tony, lots of budget speculation.
Yes, the government has made it clear that no area or very few areas of spending will be exempt in the budget. And we've already got a few whispers, or stronger than whispers, coming out about what might go to that might interest rural Australia. And one of them is the National Water Commission. Now, this was formed almost a decade ago to drive water policy reform. It audits the Murray Basin Plan and advises state and federal governments about how the monitoring and implementation of the plan is going, but it's had some cuts in funding in recent years, and scrapping it altogether would save about $30 million over 4 years. So the story goes that the National Water Commission is in for the chop. But the irrigators of Australia aren't that worried about it. National Irrigators Council Chief Executive Tom Chesson says losing the commission won't necessarily hinder the rollout of the basin plan.
If it's just a name change and all we see is the agency remain within the Department of Environment or somewhere else, will it have achieved anything? Probably not. But if it disappeared completely, would we lose sleep over it? I certainly would have a lot of empathy for some of the staff in terms of the actual organisation disappearing. No, I think it'd be a bubble on the water surface.
Now, the Coalition Minister responsible for water, Simon Birmingham, won't confirm that the Water Commission will go, but he's given some hints.
We've made it very clear that all areas of government are under review for efficiency opportunities, and of course across the water portfolio we're looking at that. That doesn't in any way undermine our commitment to deliver on our key policy promises, especially promises like delivering on the Murray-Darling Basin Plan in full and on time.
Not surprisingly, the conservationists aren't happy with this suggestion that the Water Commission will go. The Australian Conservation Foundation wants a guarantee that the funding will continue beyond this year. Jonathan Lanoz from the foundation says managing the scarcity of water remains one of Australia's biggest challenges.
There's no equivalent body at a national level that can provide the kind of leadership and accountability that the National Water Commission has over the past decade. The importance of the commission is the independence of its commissioners, their long-term tenure. They can provide clear advice without fear or favour on the progress, not just of the federal government, but also of all the state government.
And the government's also talking of perhaps cutting what's known as Medicare locals.
Yes, we're not sure what's happening with Medicare locals, but there does seem to be some sort of shake-up going around. And some of these Medicare local centres have been set up in rural areas, partly because there was a shortage of doctors and medical services allied to them. Well, there is, in fact, a suggestion all funding for the scheme could go. Now, Leslie Barclay is a health researcher. She's also on the Medicare local board for the New South Wales North Coast. She wants the system kept. She admits that it hasn't always worked where the Medicare locals fitted in with the local doctors, but she says that just needs a bit of work. The program has provided thousands of services, including better access to doctors that her region wouldn't otherwise have had.
I happen to be involved in this service, but I'm saying this as also a member of the local health district board. I'm seeing it as a researcher. This has been an element of the system that has been missing. If it's done well, with a high level of accountability, there's a whole group of rural and remote Australians who are getting care who otherwise have missed out.
And Tony, just as you and I get within grasp of retirement age, they're also talking about putting that up.
Well, the issue of putting up the retirement age and perhaps down the line making assets tests to pensions harder or making some sort of change to pensions has got a lot of farmers worried because they tend to be older. and they tend to have a lot of assets and not necessarily much money. So they're a bit worried by what might be in the budget, even though the government has given soothing noises about continuation of the pension, at least in the short term, with no changes. The Treasurer has indicated the age when people become eligible for the pension could be lifted perhaps to 70. Now, that may not make much difference for farmers who tend to just keep working and keep working anyway. But for people who work on the farms, it could make quite a difference. Andrew Dunbabin is Director of ProAdvice, a rural financial advice service. And he says one group that could be disproportionately affected by the changes to the retirement age are farm labourers. Many of them are older and they could be hit hard.
That would put a lot of farm workers in a position where they really physically can't do what they need to be able to do to justify a business employing them. The changes that are being talked about are really to deal with the bulk of Australians. They work in non-manual roles. And certainly farm workers work physically very hard. They really would be disadvantaged by the changes.
Now, amidst all this talk of the budget, the Treasurer, Joe Hockey, gave us a bit of an idea that he didn't really like the cut of the jib of the American company that was trying to buy GrainCorp.
Yes, Mr. Hockey gave us a speech and took questions at an event earlier in the week, and most of it was about the budget and was widely reported. But he was also put on the spot about his decision back in November last year to block the sale of GrainCorp, the Big Eastern State's grain handler, to the American company Archer Daniels Midland. Now, that he was widely criticised for that at the time in some sectors for A, caving into the National Party, and B, sending a signal that foreign investment was not welcome in Australia after the government had said we're open for business. At the time, he said it was against the national interest to allow ADM to buy GrainCorp. Well, this week he gave a reason. He said he had reason to believe that ADM was of not particularly good character.
That was obviously confirmed by a fine in the United States. I think it was $50 million for corrupt activity in another jurisdiction. Having said that, I formed a view that they could increase their stake, but not to the point where they could control the entity. Now, there's a test for them about whether they are determined to be a long-term investor, and if they are, they're going to have to continue to contribute and show that they can be a good corporate citizen.
Now, we're all being asked to eat more mushrooms, Tony. Why would that be?
Are you a mushroom eater?
I love my mushies.
Yeah, I'm sort of ambivalent on mushrooms. I have a few every so often. Other people in the family eat more than I do. The mushroom industry is worried there are going to be too many mushrooms around. Now, the reason for this is that Australians once only ate canned mushrooms, but over the last 30 years they've got into the fresh mushrooms. Consumption of mushrooms has grown fivefold over those three decades, and it's still one of the fastest growing horticultural sectors in Australia, worth $360 million a year to mushroom farmers. But because all these new mushrooms are coming onto the market, the price isn't going up to the farmers, and the price per kilo actually dropped by 50 cents last financial year, not that I noticed. But it didn't seem to change much. Greg Seymour from the Australian Mushroom Growers Association says growers are going to have to double their marketing levy to persuade us that we need to eat not just an average of one mushroom a day per person, but three mushrooms a day.
We're collecting around about $1.5 million on our marketing program. We want to be able to take that past $3 million. We've done all the testing and experiments in Tasmania to understand exactly what it is we've got to do to drive consumption at a level that will soak up all of the production coming on stream. We can be able to do that for around about $3.6 million.
You think they'd be pushing the mushrooms uphill to get us all to eat three a day? However, stranger things have happened, and apples are down.
Yes, apple growers in central western New South Wales, among other areas, expect lower yields this year. The growing season was hot, then it rained through harvest time. It is hoped that Tasmania can fill some of the shortfall because their crops are going to be up 20 to 25%. But in New South Wales, Peter Daly, who's an orchardist near Orange, says the Royal Gala yields were the worst affected. And the apples that do remain taste great. So he says there is an upside. The prices to farmers, because there are fewer apples, will be up.
The crops are down this year, but I think the quality's been very good. The previous year was a very tough year because of Australia-wide. There was a huge volume crop, and I think this year the crop volume is down Australia-wide. So that'll certainly equate better to a firmer wholesale price for growers.
Now, we hear of political backflips in Tassie. They've done an egg flip.
They have done an egg flip, Libby. You mightn't have noticed it if you'd have been in hospital in Tasmania or imprisoned behind the jail walls, but the food you received would have included only free-range eggs because under the previous Labor-Green state government, caged eggs were banned from government department orders. So the new Tasmanian Liberal government has done an egg flip and government departments are now allowed to tender for caged eggs. The president of the Tasmanian Commercial Egg Producers, John Grunwald, says this is a great move and he says consumers should be the ones to make the decisions.
Some government institutions will insist on free-range eggs. I think some will be more than happy with barn and some will choose to go for the cheapest option, which has always been cages. The industry has always stated it should be up to consumers to choose which system they want and it shouldn't be legislation.
Now, mention the name Cooper Petey and I immediately, of course, think opals, but I also think hot and dry.
Yes, it's pretty short in the blade of grass department at Cooper Petey. It's one of the driest places in Australia and it has applied for disaster relief from the South Australian government for flash flooding. The town's 900 kilometres north of Adelaide and it isn't used to much rain at all, but it copped 100 millimetres in a few hours earlier this month. Now, what made it so hard in Cooper Petey, of course, is that most residents live underground. If you live underground and there's a flood, you're in big trouble. The state emergency services had to give residents pumps to empty out their houses, not just brooms to wash away the water. And even the local kangaroo orphanage had a few problems. Terry Brendan Coos from the orphanage says the muddy water spooked his roos.
So they were jumping around a bit panicky because they thought they were drowning, so we had to bring them all in the kitchen. So we had five very, very wet big kangaroos jumping around the kitchen, which was good fun. Very, very muddy floors afterwards. And of course, we have slate floors, so they were slipping and sliding on the slate as well. So
there you go. Slipping and sliding underground kangaroos.
Whatever next. Tony, thank you.
Thank you.
Tony Allen with this week's Rural News. Rural Reporter is next.
Hi, it's Kate Evans here from Books Plus. If you were writing a book, what would you call it? And how would you hook me by the navel? What would be your first sentence? Tell us and you could have your own festival of reading. A book pack selected by the director of the Sydney Writers' Festival, especially for RN listeners. There'll be a winner from each state and territory. And in May, join us at the festival. Details, look for Sydney Writers' Festival on the RN homepage.
You're listening to A Country Breakfast on RN. Let's get out and about with our rural reporters. This week, a Pilbara school introduces courses with horses to help improve attendance levels. It's the end of an era when Daly Waters hosts its last BNS ball in the top end. A sculpture wall emerges in the Tasmanian wilderness and a tiny endangered native orchid makes a comeback in the lab.
So inside here we have a perfect spring. It's, you know, 23 degrees during the day and drops down to about 16 of a night, and it's like that all year round. So this is spring for me all the time in here and for the orchids.
Saving native orchids coming up soon, but let's start in the west, where school lessons have just become a whole lot more exciting.
It may not sound like it, but I am actually at one of the most important classes these kids are going to have at school today. G'day, I'm Lucy Bell and I'm standing on the basketball courts at Roebourne District High School in Western Australia's Pilbara region, where a new school subject has just been introduced. It's a special horsemanship course, where students from little kindy kids right through to year 12 are being given the opportunity to learn horse care, handling and stockman skills. It's not your typical approach to engaging students, but teachers here are hoping it will improve school attendance and self-confidence in their young charges.
My name is Lyta. I was helping to walk the horses down there. I was trying to help them feed. They eat grass.
Which one of the horses were you working with?
I was working with the white one, Hiccup.
Hiccup?
Yeah.
Laika is in kindy, and she and her classmates are amongst the first students to come and take part in this new horsemanship course. Principal Erica Prosser says it's a non-traditional way of teaching that she hopes will both tempt the kids to come to school and help them to develop stockman skills that will serve them in the long term.
I had a long discussion with community last year to see what they thought was important to students, and then I realised the rich heritage with the what was the sheep station in the old days and lots of the old stockmen that were around and very proud of that heritage, and they felt that the students had lost connection with that. So the horse program is about assisting the students to be successful at something, but it's also to reconnect with the older generations. It's not just about teaching the students about horses, it's about teamwork, self-confidence, leadership, and something to attract some of the students to come to school every day. It's also about empathy, emotional self-control, so it's a holistic way of working with students.
This morning we've seen a few of the kindergarten children having a go with the horses. We've got some students from a few of the older grades here now. What sort of engagement have you seen from the students across the board?
Oh, it's actually been quite phenomenal, the take-up. So this week we've had all the students from Year 12 down to kindy have come in. And in the background we've got one of the little guys who doesn't come to school very often, but he's been here every day and stayed every day. The horses have been here.
You can't like scream and yell next to them or they'll get frightened, and make sure you try not to stand behind them or make any fast movement. The way their fur goes, you have to brush or their hair doesn't look right, and make sure you brush for its sides and especially his mane.
Do you want to come and see the horses again?
Yeah. This is Hank. He's a quarter horse, come all the way from Inverell, New South Wales to hang out with these guys for a while.
Steve Burke is the man leading the horsemanship course over 8 weeks this school year. He absolutely towers above the little kids in his flannelette shirt and wide-brimmed hat. But he has a real calmness to his approach, and they absolutely adore him and follow him around all day long. Steve's worked with disengaged kids in the Northern Territory before, but he says Robin is the first long-term project of its kind.
We've got 8 weeks sort of spread out over through the year that we can come back and continually work with the kids. The first thing is to get them confident, so that's what this week's about. We've pretty much brought the whole school through in groups of 10 to 12 and got to get comfortable around them and do a few little exercises with them. It'll go on to where they can start to move the horses around, do a bit of groundwork and then eventually riding.
What is it that kids get from working with horses that they don't get from doing other courses or other things?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess because they are big and can be a bit scary, they've got to get their mind on the job. The whole idea is to get the kids confident enough to where they can go out and do some work experience and get to experience what it's like to go out and do a day's work and feel good at the end of it and work as a team and all that stuff that station life can bring. So there's a team of boys, 15, 16-year-old, have already sort of stepped up. They're our main helpers. So they'll be the first ones that we'll take out. We'll try and set up an opportunity where we can go out and do a real job. And that's where the real learning and the real team building happens.
Quiet, calm and slow!
Hi, I'm Max and I'm 12 years old. This is Danny, and she's a bit pushy when she wants to be.
What have you been doing with the horses this week, Max?
So I'll get the hay out and put it in their bucket. We'll put the ropes out. And then we'll fill a water up for them. Yeah, then we'll take them for a walk.
That may sound like simple chores, but Max has turned up early at school every single day to look after the horses and to help Steve set up and prepare. And he's not the only one. Proud parents have come to the basketball courts today to watch their kids from over on the bleachers. Principal Erica says the whole community has gotten behind this horsemanship project.
Oh, it's been phenomenal. We're here in probably the noisiest environment, but it's right in the heart of town on the main road. And I guess over the week we would have had over 100 people stop and have a look at the horses, and some of the real old stockmen have come in to just have a chat and look at what the kids are doing and see what Steve's up to. That's been really great, that reconnection. It's been fantastic.
Are you hoping for maybe a repeat course like this for next year, perhaps?
That's the plan. Of course, it's always down to funding, but that's our plan, is to keep this as an ongoing course. I laughingly said to Steve yesterday, did he realise when he came to the Pilbara we might not ever let him leave? So it's about getting this as a sustainable, ongoing program so that it's in every year so the students have access to it.
It'll be a wall which runs 100 metres long, 3 metres high, and it'll tell the history and stories and virtually my culture, I suppose.
Tasmanian sculptor Greg Duncan likes doing things on a grand scale. For the past decade, he's been literally carving out a niche for himself here in the small hamlet of Derwent Bridge in the very heart of Tasmania, working on his wall in the wilderness. Hello, I'm Tony Briscoe, and thousands of tourists stop in at this purpose-built gallery each year to watch the progress as Greg painstakingly carves images of Australian history into large hewn pine panels, measuring 1 metre wide and 3 metres high. Subjects cover everything from the first Aborigines to early European settlement and the extinction of the Tasmanian tiger.
Okay, well, let's go for a walk. And so when you first thought about doing it, did you realistically think that you would be able to do it?
I never had any thoughts about not being able to do it. It's only as I've got, you know, 9 years into it now that I thought, geez, what a massive task it has been. And still is for the next couple of years, because we still have more building to do, as well as I've got to keep carving.
Now, to start off with, explain about each panel of wood. What sort of wood is it? How big are they? And what sort of process do you do?
The panels themselves are laminated blocks of timber. In other words, they're made up of 20 pieces of 4x2 glued together to make a panel 1 metre wide, 3 metres high and 100mm thick. They're then stood up and carved out. So nothing's actually stuck onto the panels. Everything's carved away. It's what I call flat relief carving or flat relief sculpture. Similar to a coin in many respects, in the sense that it needs a light source. If that was taken outside and faced towards the sun, it would flatten out. So it needs a light source to give it form.
The hewn pine, what's each panel worth?
Oh, on average today, they're around about $5,000 each. Hewn pine is becoming very, very hard to get good quality hewn pine. And I've even noticed the difference carving the first lot of panels compared to what I'm finishing up with, and there is a difference in quality. It's a reasonable timber to work with. It's a middle of the road. It's probably a little bit harder to work with when it's laminated because the grains go in all directions. But no, it's good timber, but its main quality is its ability to last forever, providing a bushfire doesn't go through. It should last forever indoors.
Now let's talk about these panels. You might be able to explain to us what we're actually looking at the moment.
Well, basically what it starts with, we'll start with the Australian story, the first people in Australia, which was the Aboriginal. It'll go through to early European settlement. There'll be little stories along the line, for example, the tiger story and its demise.
There's a pretty poignant panel down here, and it tells the story of an early pioneer family, a family settling, obviously, in the farming area. It starts from the woman washing herself.
That's right, a woman in a tub, and it'll go through, it'll tell the story, perhaps of pretty much of her life and the hardships she had to bear.
Obviously, she's burying her husband, her son's with her. And it is a very sad one, isn't it?
It is. I wanted to get a feeling of that Frederick McCubbin and painters like that got, but although I wanted to do it in sculpture.
And further down this panel here, it looks like she's loaded all the stuff up and got the cow hooked up and off.
Well, this is what it would have been like when she came to the area. She's got a cart and there's chooks in the back and washing implements and a chest full of things. Well, pretty much in this part of the story, after she's buried her husband, she'll be moving on and all those things are back in the cart.
How much has this cost you to do?
I couldn't really put a figure on in dollar terms. You know, when you spend over a decade creating something like this, of this size, and building the whole thing from the ground up, right from the beginning, and funding everything yourself, it's a mighty task, and that's where I spoke to you, as I said before, you know, it's a good thing you don't really know what's ahead of you, because perhaps you might just stop and reflect probably a bit too long and not do it.
How many hours a week would you spend carving?
When I first started, I worked 2 years, it's 16 hours a day, and I did that 7 days a week for 2 years, but you can't sustain that, you just end up becoming a zombie. I still work 7 days a week, but I cut them back to 8 or 9 hour days.
Greg, just looking at a few of the blank panels, there's still obviously a lot of work to do.
Yeah, there's another, I'd say, 25 panels to be done, so I'm about three quarters of the way. That'll happen over the next 2 years, round about 2016, I'd say. The 100 panels will be completed. I'll stand back then and have a look at the whole thing and go back and finish off what I want to finish. But even when the whole 100 panels are done, there'll always be sections left unfinished. And I think it's really important when you look at a piece of work or artwork of this magnitude, you see how you get there. Just to see a smooth, polished finish in the end doesn't tell you what it was all about.
Has it been worth it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. The journey, it's been hard, but I wouldn't ever change it for any other way. It's exactly, I mean, this is what living is about. It's about learning over the years and then being able to put all that energy into something and leaving something behind. Definitely worth it.
Sculptor Greg Duncan in his unique gallery at Derwent Bridge in Tasmania. And a fair bit of work still to be done there by the sounds of things. Thanks to Tony Briscoe for that story. Still to come on Rural Reporter today, a final fling at the Daily Waters Bachelor and Spinster Ball and helps at hand for some rare and endangered Victorian orchids.
So this is, I guess, the controlled growth room where we keep all of the orchids that are growing. So inside here we have a perfect spring. It's, you know, 23 degrees during the day and drops down to about 16 of the night, and it's like that all year round. So this is spring for me all the time in here and for the orchids.
It's been a bit like trying to complete a jigsaw puzzle in the dark, finding the right combination of a seed, a rare insect and a fungus to save some tiny native orchids. And against the odds, these scientists have hit the jackpot, successfully breeding these orchid babies and propagating them, ready to plant out in a special conservation area. G'day, I'm Brett Worthington at Horsham in Western Victoria, where the Australian Network for Plant Conservation and the Wimmera Catchment Management Authority have joined forces to run this orchid conservation project. Now, this success in the lab has come at just the right moment. It's estimated there's only a handful of these native orchids left in the wild.
Hi, I'm Dr. Nushka Ryder. I'm from the Australian Network for Plant Conservation, and we're here in the Horsham Orchid Conservation Laboratory. Some really dedicated people from Amaryllis Environmental and Depi Lodden have been out there playing little pollinators in the wild, and they've been hand pollinating these plants, and they've managed to get us some seed. And we've gone out there in last winter and isolated the mycorrhizal fungi from these plants. We've taken the two back here to the lab and we put them together in the dark, and then you know, like all good partners, in a month or two they've made little babies. So we've got little baby spider orchids here now, which we're very excited about.
So you've got much more here in the lab than what you're seeing out in nature, I guess. What do you do when you find just those five? Do you want to put a little tent around them and protect them? Or like what is it that you do to make sure those ones keep going while you work back here in the lab?
Yeah, so the DEPI staff and Amaryllis Environmental, they protect these plants out in the wild. So basically by weed and rabbit maintenance, and also, yeah, some of these populations are fenced just to protect them, because they're down to the last one.
And so how do you get to the situation where it is just one? What are the major factors that are driving this decline?
So I guess some of the major factors really were land clearance, and some of these species were in the box ironbark. So on top of land clearance and where we've got some of our favourite towns now, they also were heavily mined for gold. So we lost a lot of these species from where they naturally occurred. And now, along with, I guess, managing some of those pressures and restoring some of that bush, we're looking at putting some of these federally endangered species back in.
So in many ways, is it the dream situation be that your work isn't necessary anymore because these orchids are reproducing, I guess? Is that the dream?
Yeah, Hopefully I'll become redundant in a few years, which will be quite nice, I guess, for the orchids. So in here, in these little tubs in the dark, we have these little baby orchids. So if I just reach into this tub, I can grab you the orchids here. And you can see here we've just got the fungi either side of our little baby orchids, which are almost starting to germinate. So in a few more weeks, we'll put them out under the lights. I'll just put them back so they're happy. So over here, under the lights, these are the little baby MacGyver spider orchids. So these are the ones that are down to 5 in the wild. And you can see here that we have more on one petri dish than actually exists in the wild, which is a bit of fun, really.
And so they're starting to shoot, I guess. So you've got like the tiny little white dots and then the green shoots starting to pop up.
Yeah, so you can see here the little protocorms, which are the white bits. These only have one single leaf, and so this is actually a seedling now on that plate. So when they get to about this size, which is about 2 centimetres, we then take them out and we put these up to our highly elaborate Chinese food containers, which actually turn out to be fantastic flasks. And these orchids, they really like porridge, so we feed them oats. And then the fungi comes out from that little white base bit you see, and it basically scavenges the food, and then that's what the orchid grows with. And then they grow in here for about another 6 to 8 weeks before we take them out into the nursery.
And some people might have orchids in their backyard. The ones we're talking about here in the Loddon region, do they physically look the same as what you would see in someone's garden?
Well, it depends what people have in their garden. So these are not the beautiful epiphytes that you might find that you buy in the supermarket. They come from Asia. So what we have in Australia is these tiny little orchids. They often only just have one leaf, and they might only put up a flower every couple of years. But when they do put up the flowers, they're quite spectacular. I mean, like the names say, you know, spider orchid and sun orchid, and you know, they look like the things that they describe, and they come in brilliant colours, everything from bright yellow to, you know, a really dark crimson red. So, yeah, very attractive.
So in many ways, this has been your baby in that regard. So what's that sense of pride when you then go in and reintroduce these orchids back into their natural environment?
Look, it's one of the best things that you can do, really. It makes all the work in the lab worthwhile just to be able to put them back in the wild. It's a really, really good feeling.
They have arrived here by the ute load. Some are regulars on the B&S scene, others have never been before. But there's one thing for sure, they're all here to have fun. Hello, I'm Tyne McConnon. My rural colleague Carmen Brown and I have joined about 100 partygoers here in the small Northern Territory town of Daly Waters, which is about 600 kilometres south of Darwin, for the annual Bachelor and Spinsters Ball, or better known to everyone as a B&S. And this one's a bit special. After 10 years, organisers are calling it quits and people have travelled from all over Australia for one final fling in the Territory.
Rhianna Sutherland from Canberra.
You've come up from Canberra to this B&S. Why'd you come so far?
Yeah, we were here 10 years ago for the first one, so we thought we'd come back for the last.
How does today's B&S compare to 10 years ago?
Yeah, it's still the same. They've done a lot of work here, just as hot.
What's been your favourite part of the B&S so far?
I think the road trip down. We had an adventure on the way down after losing luggage at the airport, water buffaloes on the road. It was an experience.
Have you been to many B&Ss before?
Yeah, over 100 all around Australia.
What do you love so much about B&Ss to go to over 100?
I have friends all over Australia now and they're almost like family. I can travel anywhere and pretty much know someone in a town that we go to.
When you live on a remote station, events like these offer a rare opportunity to meet new people. And with first round musters about to begin on many top end stations, the B&S also provides one last chance for the local ringers to kick up their heels.
Hey guys, Nick Murphy. I'm from Cal Station outside of Alice Springs and I'm working on Hodson River Station.
Yeah, I'm Brad Linfield. I'm from Hodson River Station.
Boys, it's the Daly Waters B&S. We're sitting out the front of the pub here. Tell me, how have you enjoyed it so far?
Oh, well, it's been awesome, you know, a bunch of people, you know, getting together. Everyone's really friendly, you know, no hostilities, and it's been a bunch of boys getting together, and girls, obviously, just having fun, you know.
Oh yeah, it's been an absolute blast, like really great weekend. Been out here for 2 days so far and everyone's just having a great time.
Yeah, my name's Fraser Young and I'm from Merrifield Station. Oh, it's beautiful. Great weekend. First weekend off in a long time and I'm just enjoying myself.
Living and working on a station, is this the main way that you meet new people at B&S's?
100%. It is the only way to really meet people, I suppose, but it's what we're here for.
Have you found there are many other people off stations here?
Basically everyone around the region is off a station or works in something to do with one, so it's a place to come to if you're from a station.
Yeah. You said it's your first weekend off in a while. How much were you looking forward to this weekend?
I've been looking forward to this since early January, so I'm here, I'm making the most of it.
While the main attraction might be the ball itself, there are plenty of other activities on offer. For regular B&S attendee Mitch, who lives in Queensland, it's the ute event which holds the most interest. And this year, he's entered a vehicle named Thrillbilly.
So she's a 70 series Land Cruiser ute, covered in stickers. I've got another B&S ute back in Queensland that was a Ford Falcon, and I named that one Thrillbilly, and I've carried the name on with the second ute. So half thrill seeker, half hillbilly, can always be found doing stupid stuff whilst wearing the trusty cowboy hat.
Now let's wander towards the back here. Just talk us through what is on this ute.
Spotlights, UHF, mud flaps, and way too many stickers.
There are a lot of stickers. You must have spent quite a bit of time collecting those. Just looking in the back here, plenty of room for the swag. Is it good to sleep in the back there?
Oh, there's plenty of room to sleep in the back there, but the swag's a little worse for wear after last night.
It doesn't take long for the rum to start flowing, and with events such as jelly wrestling and wet t-shirt competitions on the program, plenty of fun is being had by all. But by the end of the weekend, some people have had more fun than they can handle.
Beth from Essex.
Your first B&S, how did you find it last night?
Amazing.
What did you enjoy about it?
Dancing. Got really drunk and danced loads.
Yeah, g'day, I'm Whippet from the Hunter Valley in New South Wales.
How was it last night?
Wild and sideways and definitely worth it.
And what was the best part of the weekend since you've been here?
Oh, I don't know, I probably don't remember that best part.
You are looking, I don't mean to be rude, you're looking a little shabby this morning. You're covered in food dye, you've lost your shirt, you've lost your shoes. How are you feeling this morning?
Oh, I feel a lot worse than I look. That's definitely for sure.
That's Whippets from the Hunter Valley in New South Wales, ending that report by Tyne McConnon and Carmen Brown at the Daily Waters B&S Ball in the Northern Territory. And if you want to see how they ended up looking after that food dye fight, then log on to our website, abc.net.au/rural. Very pleased I'm not doing their washing. You're listening to A Country Breakfast. My name's Libby Price. Coming up, a rather stroppy federal trade minister dishing it out to ungrateful farmers who've criticised the free trade deal with Japan.
This week in This American Life, Blake's friend Camille sent him an old photograph of herself. In it, she's a little kid on vacation with her family in Canada.
And then I glanced back at the picture and I saw my grandma walking through behind her.
Blake and Camille grew up in different states. Camille didn't know him at that age or his grandma. Coincidences, do they mean anything? It's Sunday night, 7 o'clock, right here on RN.
The Federal Trade Minister, Andrew Robb, says he's bemused by the reaction of some agricultural industries to the deal he brokered with Japan earlier this month. The dairy, rice and sugar industries were particularly outspoken against the deal, which they variously called disappointing, a missed opportunity, and even as hanging Australian growers out to dry. Andrew Robb says the reaction from some sectors beggars belief and that the concessions Australia won in the deal have been undersold. Our political reporter Anna Vido sat down with Andrew Robb in Canberra.
I'm not sure what some people wanted, another 8 years, while we get left behind the rest of the world. The fact of the matter is, we've done something that's never been done by any major agricultural exporting country in terms of the concessions. For the beef industry, it's unbelievably good. The dairy industry, despite a lot of the commentary, I had meetings with them a week before I left. They were very clear about the dimension of what could be achieved, and they have grossly understated so much of what was achieved in the dairy package. It's quite bemusing to me as to, you know, are they playing just to their constituency? It really has opened up doors that were never open in Japan.
Is that really the case, though? If we look at the dairy industry particularly, what the dairy industry has secured in this agreement is an expansion of Australia's specific quota for tariff-free importation of processed cheese. I understand, though, that what dairy was really after were tariff reductions for fresh cheese. What they would really have liked was tariff reductions for milk powder and butter, but they didn't even try for those because they thought they would be a bridge too far. So haven't they really just got extra quota that they weren't using anyway?
The list is not true. I mean, they get a quota currently of 27,000 tonnes.
Globally, in fact.
Yeah, well, it's part of a global quota. They get 27,000 tonnes of it duty-free. On top of that, there's about another 60,000 tonnes sold with a tariff of 29%. They wanted that 29% down. I agree with that. But they called us off. I can show you the email which says back off the 29% and concentrate on other areas. And then they came out when it was announced and they criticised us for that not getting more on that 29%. Fact is, we got an extra 20,000 tonnes. There was 12 on the table when I met them. 20,000 tonnes extra, duty-free. And not only duty-free, it doesn't have to be matched by local cheese, right, which is another
restriction. Yeah.
But also, you know, bear in mind, we've got a halving of 40% tariff for processed cheese over 10 years, tariff reductions on grated and powdered cheese, 20% tariff reduction on blue vein cheese, no volume restrictions, tariffs on casein, milk protein concentrates and lactose eliminated immediately. They're all markets that could end up as $100 million markets, and yet we've got this hysteria that came out of some sections of the dairy industry, and it just beggars belief, really,
so
when all those things I've just read through are real advantages for the industry, and many sections of the industry have come back to me privately and said they're very pleased about all of these doors that have been opened.
Why do you think, then, that that's been the reaction of among the dairy sector in particular?
Well, I was a senior figure in agri-politics years ago, too long ago, unfortunately. Some play to their constituency, and it's happened again. I think it's short-sighted. It is an unprecedented breakthrough, and it's not the finish, it's the start. And I think things like the TPP, I was very mindful of that. I think the TPP will go further with Japan. And I think what we've done is just the start for Japan, not the finish by any stretch.
The next thing, of course, the next cab off the rank is China. The investment question is going to be an interesting one, and certainly the Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, had some interesting comments to make at the end of his trip, particularly the fact that he's open to at least considering whether or not Australia should soften its regulations around investment in Australia by state-owned companies. To what extent is that a deal-breaker for China, whether or not Australia is prepared to do something like that?
That is perhaps one of their major issues, and we have to look at that. Clearly, every country's got state-owned enterprises, but China's predominantly state-owned enterprises, and the question is, are the state-owned enterprises conducting themselves in the same way as a private enterprise? Now, that's the sort of issue that we're looking at, and there are things such as what's called greenfields development, new developments. In that case, where we can't get anyone else to invest and they come in as a greenfields development, we haven't got a lot to lose in that situation. They're bringing their own money, pouring it into a new development, and these are the sorts of things we're saying, well, let's have a look at, you know, where SOEs could come in to our advantage and still consistent with the intent of our legislation.
The politics of this is difficult, though, isn't it? Internationally, quite apart from domestically, to what extent is Australia actually in a position where we could offer such a concession to China when we haven't offered it to other important trading partners like Indonesia, clearly, or even Japan or Korea?
Well, we haven't done a deal with Indonesia. We're in the process of considering one. Japan and Korea are not dominated. Korea's got more SOEs, but they're not dominated. Japan's not. So the countries are in quite different situations.
So you don't think we'd be irritating our other trading partners if we were to offer that to China?
No, I don't. I mean, it's what is it we're offering? We haven't made any decisions yet. We're starting to sort of put some ideas out there so we can explore it with the Chinese. It's not going to, in any sense, be open slather. We have got rules. They apply universally. Whatever rules we come up with, I think, ought to be able to be applied ultimately to other countries if they meet the same conditions that we lay down.
The coalition obviously came to power promising tighter restrictions on foreign investment as far as agricultural land and agribusiness are concerned. There's clearly concern in the Australian community about foreign investment. How do you sell such a relaxation in the rules?
Well, I say to you, firstly, there's always been concern. As long as I've been around, every time there's a new wave of investment, the community gets concerned about, and the rhetoric's the same, the concerns are the same.
Your National Party colleagues are concerned too.
Well, that was true in the 80s when I was running the National Farmers Federation in Japan, were coming in with lots of money. The same arguments were put in the 1940s, 2 years after the US had saved us. The whole reason the Foreign Investment Review Board's in place is because of concern about the Americans' investment in Australia back after the war. But the thing is, they can't tie the tractor up to a fence and pull the farm away. The thing is, we've got to be realistic. We've just got to be sensible in how we manage it. I do understand the concerns that people have. That's why we're not going to have open slather. That's why the rules we set with our National Party colleagues, $15 million as a threshold for private, for agricultural land, and $53 million for agribusiness. We have got those, both of those, embodied in the Japan and the Korean agreements, and they'll be in the Chinese agreement.
Federal Trade Minister Andrew Robb speaking to our reporter Anna Vido in Canberra. And if you'd like to hear more of that interview, it's available online, abc.net.au/rural. After several pretty tough seasons for cattle producers, things are looking up. Indeed, producers in the top end say they're getting the best prices ever, with $2.10 a kilo for heifers and $2.30 a kilo for steers heading to Indonesia. Mike Shaw is very happy. He's from Spring Creek Station on the border of the Territory in Western Australia. He told Tyne McConnon it's the start of a season he's been desperate for.
The yards at Spring Creek Station are like a production line at the moment. It's almost like a beehive. There's people going everywhere, there's heifers going everywhere, and it's all because a truck is coming in about 4 days to pick up to about 300 heifers and 300 steers, which are going to Indonesia. I'm actually standing here alongside the yards with Spring Creek owner Mike Shaw. Now, Mike, what has to actually be done before any of these actually get on the boat? What are you checking for here today?
Well, this line here now, we've already gone through this line. There's about 250 left here now. We went through that and peg-tested them ourselves and got all the definite pregnants out. There's a couple here we're not quite sure of, you know, just in calf. Now we've got the vet here, come over from Catherine. Flew in this morning. He's been doing myself, Rosewood and Waterloo. Now he's got to peg-test them and give us a certificate to say they're definitely not in calf.
Are you weighing them here also today?
Yeah, we are. We're just, I've got actually all my, well, most of my number twos, usually there's a lot more pregnant, but last year there was a bloody, we're in such a dry year last year, a lot of these aren't in calf this year. Like usually 50% are going to be in calf, but not this year. There's about, oh, probably 25% in calf. So we've got to weigh them, and the ones that are over the let's say 360, are out because they're too heavy. The ones below 270 are too light, so they're out as well.
Are you finding that you've got a few that fit the requirements at the moment, though?
Oh, yeah, no, we're right. Yeah, no, I've got the number. Yeah, probably good.
How good is the price at the moment, Mike?
$2.10 for these heifers, $2.30 for the steers.
How long?
The highest price ever.
Highest price ever. So you haven't seen prices like this for ever?
Never. Never.
Do you have many already sold for the season? Have you already got many organised for the rest of the season yet?
No, we'll just keep going through like this. As we pick up these heifers, we'll keep preg testing. Most of my steers, now I've taken the lead out of my steers, but there's 300. And then I'll have some more to go in about, say, 4 months' time, and then some more a bit later on. But I've got heavy cows to go yet, ones we spayed in the last few years. And I might have to sell some pregnant cows, depends on how financial I need to be and pay the bank back and pay the school fees and all the rest of it.
Yeah, speaking of that, I remember standing here last year and things were pretty negative. It was dry, the season wasn't looking good, and you're coming off a bad season. How are you feeling standing here this year?
Yeah, no, a lot better this year. I think I speak for a lot of people. I don't think there's too many private operators who could have kept going on. We couldn't keep going for too many more years without the bank starting to, hey, we want some of our money back. You know, we couldn't keep going. And last year was a dry year for me. Not everyone was dry. Like, I was very dry last year, second driest on record, only by 40 mil too, I might add.
Is a good season just in time, maybe, for many producers?
It is. It is. Especially little, small private operators, I think. You know, the big companies, they can override things, but small, little private fellas behind me. She'd been a tough few years, I tell you. Yeah.
There's a lot of talk about China as a new market coming on and that need for beef over there. Indonesia's permits are also gone up in the second quarter. Vietnam's another one.
Yep.
How good is it to hear that news? Do you think that you've got over that hard bit and there might be some easier times to come?
Yeah, I think we're right. I think everything's going good. Don't any of them politicians upset those Asian countries, for God's sake. Otherwise, it's all looking good. And in fact, my bank man came around last year and he was very positive about the industry. But that's a good sign. When the bank man's a positive, it's a good sign.
Mike Shaw from Spring Creek Station in the Kimberley, speaking there with Tyne McConnon. It's also been an excellent few months for farmers who produce prime lambs. In Horsham, in Western Victoria, the sale yards posted its best March in years. Brett Worthington headed along to this week's lamb sale for a bit of a look-see.
59, Chanda, 59, NCH, number one. Here they are, two. They are two.
Paul Christopher, Horsham Regional Livestock Exchange Superintending Manager.
So we're just in that awkward period between Easter and Anzac Day, but from my understanding, March was a really solid month here at Horsham. Can you take us through what you saw?
Yeah, look, going back through the figures, I've been out here now for nearly 9 years, and it was definitely the biggest sale that I've been involved with. So I went back through the figures, and it turned out to be the biggest March on record that we've had at the Horsham Regional Livestock Exchange. I think that's to do with the price. The price was fantastic, so our farmers have got the confidence to bring them in here, and they got good money, so the numbers kept coming in. This one was down a little bit because of the short week, but I'm expecting that the numbers will climb up again next week.
So it has, that form has carried into April, where you were seeing solid prices and solid numbers passing through?
Most certainly, yes. The numbers have been fantastic for the two sales before Easter. Of course, we have the Easter week off, and then this week was down to about 13,500, but next week I'm expecting that we'll have a few more.
Yep, they're younger hands. You want them that way again, boys? They're right up there. All of a sudden, they're 35.
Yes.
Nine.
Yes.
Yes. Half six. Half
seven.
How
many is it?
Half eight.
Put them in the number
half
three.
Nine. Half 40.
A couple of farmers I was chatting to were saying there was a real sense of the mood changing and kind of a nice spirit at the moment. Is that what you're seeing at the markets at the moment?
Oh, definitely. When the prices are good and farmers are getting more than they expect, it's very jovial and you see smiles on the faces. And look, they're probably getting what lambs are worth, and it's worthwhile, you know, having them and breeding lambs, certainly.
Obviously, selling's a seasonal thing and supply and demand factors will affect things. But what are you thinking as we edge towards the end of April and into May and deeper into winter?
Look, I'd love to have a crystal ball, but my thoughts on it would be that there's lambs, of course, on the ground now. There's ewe lambing, and I would have thought the numbers have got to come from somewhere. So I would think that this spring it will be good prices. How good, like I said, the crystal ball, we don't know, but I would think supply and demand will be good, and then we'll just have to see how we go further on down the track.
In your 9-year tenure, you would have seen some of those drought years and just how bad things got. And if you look at things today, how does the mood today reflect the other years that you've been here?
Oh, look, yeah, jovial. And it was like this 4 years ago when lambs creeped up into the $200 mark. I think it's just a sense of you're getting good money for your produce. It's like grain or anything. If you can get good money, it makes you happier. But those that stick through, I think farming is all about peaks and troughs. And if they can, you know, say somewhere in the middle, people are happy to do it.
And just on the broader outlook, there might be a softening of prices, but you are confident that things could remain quite strong here at Horsham?
I would think so, yeah. I'm hoping that for myself. I'm a lamb producer myself. But just looking into it, I can't see that there's going to be a lot of numbers around. So you'd think that people that have stuck by their lamb would do quite well in the springtime.
97.5, done. 97.5.
Paul Christopher from the Horsham Livestock Exchange speaking there with Brett Worthington. Isn't it great to hear some good news at last for farmers? That is all we have time for today. If you'd like to look at some of the wonderful photographs taken for today's stories, Read some more of the news or listen back to the podcast of the program, just head to our website, abc.net.au/rural. Terrific having your company this morning, and a big thank you to our technical producer, John Jacobs. On RN, my name's Libby Price. I'll talk to you next week on A Country Breakfast.